Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In some ways, we've become adversarial.
Yeah.
I'm proud that there are pills that can help.
Yes.
But people hate pills. But if they become the drivers, they'll see that pills are this option for them. Pills are their partner if their own changes and their own modifications to their diet, their well-being, their thoughts, their lifestyle, if that's not enough, we can supplement a little bit. If you change your diet and your cholesterol doesn't go down as much as we need it to, then we'll bring in pill at a lower dose. That way, people respect what docs do, medics do, and medics respect that people need to be treated as individuals and drive their own care.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we discuss the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. These are some of the things that I've written about in my latest book, Eat to Beat Illness. And today I'm speaking to Dr. Rahul Jandio, an American dual-trained neurosurgeon and scientist at the City of Hope, a research center, hospital, and postgraduate training facility in Los Angeles. He's well known for his cutting-edge approach to brain surgery and neuroscience and has absolutely transformed the lives of his neurosurgical patients by putting them through his specially developed boot camp for restoring brain function. He's written an eye-opening, informative, and accessible guide, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon, where he uses his years of experience to show how healthy people can rewire their brains to work in a higher gear. And this is what we'll be chatting about on today's show. And when I first thought I'd be getting Dr. Rahul on the show, I thought it was going to be quite a technical show, talking a lot about the intricacies of the human brain and how we can, you know, do hacks and tips and tricks and that kind of stuff. But what this podcast really was about, and I think it's so special, is just how humble Dr. Rahul is. His learnings from his practice, how connected he is to his family, and genuinely his experience in London. He's thought of this process of writing a book and being asked to come to London and speak at events as just such a wonderful opportunity, and it really does come across. He has plenty of anecdotes in this podcast, but plenty more in the book, and I absolutely love his writing style. Blending smart brain hacks with case studies and storytelling from his own experience is something that he is truly a master at, and I highly recommend you pick up a copy, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon. I really hope you enjoy listening to this episode. The recipe will be on thedoctorskitchen.com, and you can see the video recipe on YouTube as well, thedoctorskitchen.com. There is a lot of evidence-based, safe dietary lifestyle change that we as practitioners can be confidently discussing with our patients. And this is something that Dr. Rahul truly resonates with. And it's just so humbling to be able to speak to a super specialist, someone who does brain surgery for brain cancers for a living. It's someone who just gets it. And I really hope you listen to the end. I'm going to summarize what we sort of talked about in terms of brain hacks and stuff. But this is more about his journey of maturing into a medical student, into someone who wants to specialize, in his experiences along the way. I truly hope you enjoy this as much as I loved making it. On to the podcast. I'm going to be cooking for you a wild mushroom tarragon fricasse. It's going to have some walnuts, some broad beans, a little bit of tomatoes, some sort of traditional flavors of shallot, banana shallot, and some garlic and courgettes. Sound all right?
That sounds great.
Good. We're just going to put this in a little bit of butter and some extra virgin olive oil. Very low sort of heat cooking, so we're not burning that extra virgin olive oil, which we know has got good brain health benefits. And the sort of overriding flavor is going to be the wild mushroom, but it's going to be kind of mellowed with the tarragon, hopefully. So, yeah.
Let's enjoy.
Yeah. So, you're in London for 10 days. How's your journey been so far?
It's been fantastic.
Yeah.
We were talking about that on the way in.
Yeah.
People keep asking me, are you breaking the jet lag and how's it going with that and your techniques for breaking jet lag? And my answer is, we're not breaking jet lag at all. We're going hard day and night.
Yeah.
So I'm here with my son.
Yeah.
You met him. He's 14.
Yeah.
And it's quite a maturation experience for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
The journey and the places we're going to are not accessible to just people who are here for tourism, so I feel honored and humbled by the perspective and view I'm getting of Londoners, and it's been fantastic. So we did some additional stuff. We went to Stonehenge, as I told you. We did a bike ride for a couple hours. We went to Tate Britain to see Van Gogh.
Yeah.
And all the stuff related to the book as well, and a different restaurant every night. We went to a tandoor kebab. It was like a tapas tandoor thing. It was excellent.
Yeah. Whereabouts was it? Is it East London or?
It was close to where we're staying by Trafalgar Square.
Okay.
I don't know how to say that just right, but it's
You said it perfectly. That's perfect, yeah.
And then one night we went to an Italian restaurant. Last night we went to Banconi. That was phenomenal.
Yeah.
At a recommendation. And so we're we're going for it, you know. We're savoring this this week.
Yeah, oh, that's great. And you're going to Edinburgh as well tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow, train to Edinburgh. I want to see wherever I go with them. We do city.
Yeah.
I travel with all my boys and my wife.
Yeah.
But I travel with each of my boys once a year to a far off place alone. The communication is different when it's just me and one boy.
Yeah.
You get all of them together. It's wild. It's great too.
Yeah.
But one at a time, and I like to see the city, so we get a pulse of the energy, and just I can see how they're navigating a busy space.
Yeah.
And then I like to see the land right outside of the city, because sometimes cities start to blur, you know. They've got similar restaurants and similar subways.
Absolutely,
I think Mexico City might have the same design for the tube as you guys are.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, something like that is borrowed down there.
Uh-huh.
I'm not 100% sure, but you start to see these overlapping similarities. And so I like to get out a few hours to... What do the trees look like? What does the land look like?
Yeah.
What do the people look like outside the city? So that's where we're... So tomorrow's Edinburgh.
I've done the same, actually, with LA. So I've got a few of my friends that live there, and we go over hikes just outside the city.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gives you a real sense of how real people live in that part of the world, right? Because otherwise you just see, like you said, the sort of same museum and tube network and restaurant scene.
Heavy on the garlic and onions.
I'm
all for that.
So I've just chopped up the shallot and the garlic, and it's going in. So we're getting the proper French sort of style flavors here. And I'm not scared of using like a little bit of butter, even though, yes, it has saturated fats and stuff, but, you know, in moderation, these quantities.
Yeah, it's not the indulgences, it's the habits. That's an interesting thing. You know, these in LA, people go on a diet and they say, if, you know, they've stayed on the diet for 24 days and then they have a burger, they think it undoes the value of those 24 days. It doesn't.
Yeah,
the indulgences never hurt the body.
Yeah.
It's the habits that get us.
Absolutely. And so how would you describe you growing up and eating food? Like, what was your connection with it? Was it something that was important, or was it something that you've only recently got into?
You know, I don't remember food being remarkable when I was young. Mm-hmm. I don't remember music being remarkable when I was young, even though those are things I love now. I think as a teenager in Los Angeles, in the 1980s and 90s, it was such a toxic environment that I almost feel like it was living under just this constant threat. So the things I enjoy now, either I wasn't exposed to them or I didn't cultivate them. So I don't remember much of food. I do remember the first time thinking about food was in the university,
right,
when they had the cafeterias.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then they had all kinds of different food. I think like meatloaf and
yeah.
pasta. And that was the first time I noticed there were different cheeses.
Yeah.
I met my wife, my wife now. Back then, when I met her, she was the first person to take me to sushi. Mm. And now I'm just, I'm not a sushi snob, but
yeah.
I am a sushi connoisseur. I'll eat California roll. That's like French fries.
Yeah.
I like
yeah.
it. I'll take it anytime. But yeah. I've also indulged and gone to, you know, Masa in New York City, which is a Michelin 3. I don't get into the ratings. And if there is something, I like San Pellegrino's
yeah.
Ratings
yeah.
more young and creative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their top 50, whatever uh-huh. it is. But I went with my teenage son, and it was pricey. We indulged. We cut the money for the hotel budget.
Yeah, yeah.
We
yeah.
raised the
and
money.
And raised it for everything else.
And it was
yeah.
$700 each.
Really?
Omakase.
Wow.
Was it
$700 worth it?
It was.
Oh, wow. That's the most important thing,
yeah.
right?
So. We made a couple of jokes.
Yeah.
He was 16 then.
Yeah.
My son Kai is here now. Zane went with me to New York.
Uh-huh.
We made a couple of jokes looking at each other, and we went, last meal.
Yeah.
Meaning, like, if
yeah,
we
yeah,
were,
yeah.
it's kind of a macabre thing to bring
yeah,
up.
Yeah, totally.
Last
yeah.
meal. And we've extended that to what would be your last bite?
Uh-huh.
You know, the last
uh-huh.
flavor
yeah.
you want to enjoy in some sort of strange hypothetical situation.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, I don't know what it is for you, but for me, it would be uni.
Uni?
Uni.
What, remind me what uni is?
It's sea urchin.
Oh, wow.
Sea urchin. Okay. With seaweed paper, just to soften it with a little salt. That
I don't
is
think
my,
I've even eaten that.
Yeah, it's
wow.
It's a little bit like I don't know how to explain it. I think it's got the smokiness of a good scotch,
uh-huh.
the texture of pate almost.
Okay. Yeah.
With a bit of like it's got, you know, it's briny,
uh-huh.
enjoyable briny.
Yeah.
It's not fishy. You know,
yeah.
It's the. I think
it's not what people typically would assume would be like, you know, raw fish or
yeah,
know,
But there is a hint of ocean to it.
Okay, yeah,
and
yeah.
It's something you desire.
Uh-huh.
The Japanese have something about that. So, sea urchin is. And so when you come to LA, and if we ever hook up,
yeah,
north of LA to Santa Barbara, 100 kilometers, they actually have great sea urchin in the Santa Barbara pier.
Amazing.
You just go to the pier and get. It doesn't have to be an exclusive
yeah,
access
yeah.
thing, but. So it's been fun bringing food in with the kids. And,
yeah.
you know, what I noticed was, so then jump forward, I've got teenage kids. I do want them to be as robust as they can be,
uh-huh.
psychologically and physically. And then, so we started telling them, don't eat junk food, don't eat that, don't eat, but we didn't give them an alternative.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, with kids, it's like, all right, you took all the good stuff out
yeah,
of the closet,
out,
like
yeah,
a pantry,
yeah, yeah.
but there's nothing left.
Yeah.
So now, I would say in the last, I prepared my first meal for Mother's Day this year for my mom.
You prepared your first meal?
For, like, company.
Oh, okay, fine, yeah, yeah, okay.
It was just my, you know, my brother and my mom, and
uh-huh.
and it was just a gesture to her. Last year, my father, her husband, passed away, so mm-hmm. it was sort of like, you know, you... we're going to pay a lot of attention to you, Mom.
Yeah,
I love you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And what I found that I'm good at is baking fish.
Baking fish, okay.
I can bake a killer salmon.
Yeah, yeah. In like baking paper, is that how you do it? Or like
I do it
in foil
and
okay,
in the toaster oven. It's
yeah.
a strange thing.
Yeah.
I feel like I can predict. I guess that's the surgical thing in me. I need... I can control the temperature and predict the timing better than the big oven.
Right, right, yeah.
Sometimes it says it's 350, but I don't know, it doesn't feel like it, and I don't want to put the extra thermometer in there.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
so I do this, and what I realized was if you get reasonable fish and meat, and mm-hmm. I tend not to eat a lot of meat, but that's a different topic we'll get into. Mm-hmm. I think it's, mm-hmm. again, being a cancer surgeon, I'm trying to lean away from eating flesh. Something about it is there's some cognitive dissonance I'm going through about operating on patients and
yeah.
eating flesh. Something's not vibing with me as I'm
yeah.
getting older. But for my family, I put the you get the salmon,
mm-hmm.
you put it on a long sheet of aluminum foil.
Mm-hmm.
It's olive oil and whatever spice you want on top. There's
yeah.
like a salmon seasoning powder. And just close it like a little envelope.
Yeah.
And it's 30 minutes at 350.
All right, okay,
and it's
yeah.
just like, it's perfect every
yeah.
time.
We've been chatting for food the whole time, but you're here promoting your incredible book, Life Lessons by a Brain Surgeon, from a Brain Surgeon. How's it all going? It's already become a bestseller in the UK in a couple of weeks.
I you know, the funny thing is I try not to look at that. Even my own social media, my Instagram, yeah. I have somebody, I give the material to them.
Yeah.
And say, over the next month, here's some cool images and some interesting thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like to walk away from it.
Yeah.
For me, the constant connection with social media rankings, because I'm sort of I'm a competitive person. I'm
sensitive.
We have
to be your brain surgeon.
Yeah. So, yeah. You want me to be competitive, casual.
Exactly.
But
yeah, yeah.
So for me, creatively, it helps to look at things once a week.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's Sunday. Let's see how the week went. So I haven't looked at it, but it has been... it has been a delight because the publisher, Venetia, and her team at Penguin, they suggested the title.
Oh, right, okay.
It's my heart and soul over the last 15 years of collecting stories and waiting till I was mature enough in the field, I had enough gravitas to... Otherwise, it's like, who is this guy telling us about our brains?
How dare
he speak about something so complex and personal?
Because you said that at the start of the book, you've been waiting to write this book for years.
In the States, we get a lot of quick experts.
Okay, yeah.
Self-declared experts, they get some promotion. And then you look at the track record and it's lacking. I didn't want to fall into that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what she did and what they did is they put the word stories in the subtitle, and I really, really am indebted to them for that.
Yeah.
Every chapter starts with 3 or 4 pages of a standalone gripping story.
Mm.
And can I give you the one about food?
Please do, because that's the one where you go to Ukraine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal story.
And it's decades established.
Yeah.
Yet it's considered new.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's our job, right? Yeah. Like all the... how did medicine and surgery become the worst communicators in the world?
Yeah, yeah.
We're sitting on this giant body of knowledge. We just can't explain it to people. We haven't shared it with people. Mm. But, you know, the brain is an electrical entity. It's flesh that sparks. I like to think of it as 80 billion tiny jellyfish inside an aquarium. And sometimes that electricity is aberrant, just like you can have a heart arrhythmia, and people get that. Like, my heartbeat is off.
Yeah.
Well, your brain electricity can be off, and it's called having a seizure, and if you have more than one, it's called epilepsy. And if you can't afford medicine as kids, or the medicines that they have are not working, I was on a floor in Ukraine, and the moms were in the bed with the kids, and they had little frying pans in the corner, and it's just cooking only fat.
Yeah.
And we have known for a long time an all-fat diet can be used to treat epilepsy. And I said, there is the premise that I can start from to say, what can Rahul say about food?
Yeah.
And food can heal. It's in all the journals. You might think it's wild now. Mm. Just go on and look that up.
Yeah.
All-fat diet for intractable epilepsy. Mm-hmm. And then when I was reading that, I saw this quote by Hippocrates, and I said, this is it. And it was, let food be thy medicine. Mm. And so, how did we get from that to the way we eat and live now in the States and here? It's just, and then, I would say, on the flip side, food can be thy poison.
Exactly, yeah.
And so, from there, I built this chapter that went into the mind diet and intermittent fasting. But that's, you know, you should ask, why can Rahul talk about food?
Yeah.
He doesn't cook.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
I'd love for you to try this. So, this is the wild mushroom fricassee with tarragon. You can give us your honest opinion as well, because...
No, I mean, that's my flaw.
Yeah, yeah.
But tell me some of the components, because I'm not familiar with them. I know items like sushi and grilling, but otherwise I'm quite ignorant about...
So we have got broad beans at the moment. This is a seasonal ingredient. I think you guys call it fava beans.
Oh, yes, fava beans. Now
I get it. So these are just cooked or lightly steamed and then thrown in afterwards as well. So it's got a lot of fiber. It's a protein source as well. It's a very bland. It's sort of like a giant pea. Mm-hmm. But it's a very bland sort of ingredient, so that's why you've got to use punchy flavors like tarragon, nigella seeds, and a little bit of wild mushroom to really bring it out. I've also added some walnuts in there because we know it's got a good source of short chain omega-3 fatty acids. tarragon, all these different simple herbs that have phenomenal phytochemical properties that can reduce inflammation in the body, may have some brain health benefits as well. Just generally looking after your internal ecosystem is what I'm about, because the body has good this work. Innate amazing ability to look after itself. And that sounds a bit woo-woo, but actually if you put your body in the right environment.
Let me just jump in there. We use the word environment when we talk about the brain. Mm. So much so, there are words like synaptic pruning. Mm-hmm. That's like in a neuroscience journal.
Yeah.
And that's the right way to think of it. It's not as these like modular, compartmentalized things. Mm-hmm. There is a ecosystem inside us. Mm-hmm. And to take it into a different direction, into a disease direction, because I learned from that. Mm-hmm. If you have breast cancer, there's a different environment and the cancer is growing in a certain way and looking for certain nutrients and fuel sources. When it swims to other parts of the body, like to the brain, which is my specialty is, it morphs and drinks different kind of juices in a new environment.
Yeah.
We speak of the microenvironment inside the brain. And so your suggestion or that you posit that our body is an environment and it can be healed and brought to a better homeostasis, if you were. These are the kind of words we need to bring out to the public, so it's not eat one blueberry and it's a brain food.
Yeah, exactly.
Change this one thing
and
you will be skinny and gorgeous and healthy, you know? And that's exactly where we need better, more impeccable language. Mm. And so environment is exactly that.
Yeah, absolutely. Great.
I love the mushrooms.
Yeah.
The walnuts for me are a little bitter, but that's why people do the... but they're so good for you.
Yeah.
What I do with the kids is I sprinkle a few M&M's.
M&M's into it. Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, they're a little bit more bitter because I've toasted them slightly just to bring out some of these essential oils. But a good suggestion, because it was either going to be walnuts, but if you prefer like a slightly softer nut, pine nuts work brilliantly. Mm. Yeah, they're wonderful. So
I like it.
Good. I'm glad. I like
No, I do, and I love the mushrooms in there. It gives it that fleshy flavor without without flesh.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be plant-focused, tons of fiber, you know, quality fats, not getting rid of all fats. Fats are super important. A ton of different colors. And once you hit those sort of markers, you're looking at a diet that can improve, yes, your brain, but also your skin, immunity, your mental health simultaneously. And it's like we were talking, you know, that internal environment, how the body has this innate mechanism to sort of look after itself. And homeostasis is a concept that just fascinates me. You know, it's something that we have lost the balance of. And I think once we push people towards that state, then it's, things just seem to click into place.
Yeah, and if diseases could be treated without medicines, you know, that would be a huge advancement for us. It's almost like medicine was made and it helped. I mean, of course, I give these talks for City of Hope about inventing medicine, right? Because people, what do you, do research? I don't know what that means. Do you study where cholera spreads? Yeah. Do you study car accident research? No, we invent medicine. Yeah. We manipulate cancer cells and squirt things that kill them and then try to bring them to patients in that process. And so medicine is important. Before we get to, we have too much of it.
Yeah.
Early 1900s, the top three killers were infection, mm-hmm. you know. And then there was penicillin.
Yeah.
Changed a lot of things mm-hmm. for the better. There's no question that is... That's a medicine you want to keep around.
Yeah, yeah.
People say, I don't like to take pills. No, you want that one.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to die from an ingrown toenail,
as
people used to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there was a virus, you know, and then Salk vaccine.
Mm.
And in San Diego, where I got my PhD, there's a Salk Center. And he never got a patent for it. He's like, I don't want the money with this. I just want it out there.
Really? Yeah, I didn't realize that. Yeah. Wow.
So the Salk vaccine, polio.
Yeah.
But there were pictures of children and people using crutches and these sort of things.
Yeah.
That's a powerful thing. You know, that's legacy. And then how old was I then? I had dropped out of university for 2 years.
I wanted to talk to you about this, actually, because this, like, kind of intuit into the book is your own experience of kind of losing the passion for what your undergraduate was in, and then you were a security guard at cafeteria, where you ultimately met your wife, which is a good,
The other day I was at Stella McCartney, I said, my current wife, and I said, I mean my only wife, and they tore me up, and my son was there, and he just covered his eyes, and he was like, God, that's dad, so funny. What is that? Dad is himself at... Dad is actually still thinks he's in his kitchen.
Yeah.
Talking like he's in his kitchen.
I have a friend actually that refers to her husband as her first husband. Like, this is my first husband. He's like, can you stop saying that? He's like, I'm just trying to keep you on your toes.
No, I like that. No, we have to choose to be married daily.
Yeah.
That's funny. I never liked studying. This is not some... My mom and dad will be... my dad... in the past, you know, and when you get older and your kids are around, they're like, listen, nobody hated studying more than your dad, Raul. He would tell my kids. So you don't have to love it to realize it's a path to somewhere. And it's an opportunity that many don't have. So it doesn't matter. That was one perspective. They never pushed school a lot. They just said, get straight A's and we won't push school a lot. We'll leave you alone if you get straight A's.
Yeah.
So I got straight A's. And I didn't. I was the master in my school of getting just 90%. I never tried to get... Why get extra? This gets me the little letter, right? Okay, fine. I'm going to go party.
Yeah.
So I had a wild youth. You know, I had some wild friends. And it makes sense. My hormones were going. My frontal lobes were trying to figure out... what's inhibition and what's disinhibition. We also know a lot of mental health issues spike at that time. So there's something going on that's magical in your late teens and early 20s. And when I got to college, it was just to get away from LA, frankly. I went to a university I had never set eyes on.
Really?
Yeah. My brother went there. I was like, it's Northern California. I never looked at it. I just wanted to get out of LA. And I was young. I was 17. And I asked my mom, why am I 17 and a senior? Why am I the youngest kid in my class? She's like, well, we had an opportunity to get you to start school early. So we started you early because you were such a nuisance when you were a toddler. She's an attractive, not older, but less young woman. Okay, and she's got a full head of hair. And she'll just sit there just deadpan and say that in a room full of people.
You
were a headache as a toddler. So we got you started early. That's why it lands so well. But when I got there, I was young and I had never enjoyed. And San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley, with their version of the tube, I didn't have a car finally. It was great. They had a metro, it's called the BART. And people were different up there. Northern California is very different than Southern California. It wasn't as adversarial. When men looked at each other, it wasn't like road rage or are we going to fight, And I started to realize I needed some personal health and psychological development that this place was providing me. And once again, I wasn't studying and I was getting B's and C's. And so I thought, let me take some time. Worst case scenario, I come back and get all C's and I still get my diploma. I don't lack strategy. So I thought, I'll finish this because I'm not doing anything and I'm still passing. But maybe I'll take some time off and do something different. That time off, three things happened. San Francisco General was in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, and that was the hub. They had books written about it, San Francisco General Hospital. I think the Facebook guys put his name on there, and I don't know how I feel about buying sanctuaries, if you will. I'll just leave it at that. Putting your name on it. I get buying stadiums. All the stadiums in the States are now, Petco Park.
But this is very different though, isn't it?
It's a sanctuary. People go there to die. You get your neon sign up there. That doesn't make sense to me. Back then, and in my heart, it's still San Francisco General. And I saw people, I was volunteering, and all I was doing was wiping blood off gurneys. But it was like, whoa, there's more going on in here than is actually outside in San Francisco. And San Francisco is a wild place. So it became this like aquarium. And I realized I don't like studying, but I like studying people. And then at the same time, my mom got breast cancer. So
at that time. Those things were considered, my mom got breast cancer, at that time it was considered terminal, but it wasn't. She's around, we live together now, she's with me. My dad passed away last year, so she's living with me and my three sons and my wife, my first wife, my current wife, my only wife. only wife to be. And I dedicated the book to her.
Yeah,
in all seriousness, to the love of my life.
Yeah.
So in case she leaves me, the dedication still applies.
Yeah.
Love of my life. That's how I describe this relationship with this woman.
Was she quite pivotal in terms of you sticking with medicine or going to medicine?
She didn't want me to change. That was an interesting thing too. It wasn't like, calm down, or be more motivated, or it was just, Take all that you are, all the heat, all the intensity, all the craziness, the wild, whatever it is, just put it to good use, you know? Deliver it with purpose. It was such a, and the word I can say is, because in the States, it's all about, you know, calming down, finding Zen, all that. I get that, and I like that. It just didn't apply to me. Mm. I'm not diminishing other people's narrative, but that's not my narrative. My narrative was, be badass, just put it to good use.
Yeah.
Just don't be destructive with it. But hold the energy and redirect it. So I call it sublimation, you know. So the confluence of those three things meant, I'll try to get into medical school. Because I never thought about law or account. I'm just, you know, I'm not that guy. It was going to be either that or become a police detective or a firefighter. It was not going to be, I'll go into law or an accountant. I'm not, again, not diminishing those professions. Mm. It's just not my narrative. Mm. But my grades sucked, right? Because I was getting all those C's. So then the climb back was brutal. Because at that time in the States, the dot-com bubble had burst and all the engineers were trying to pivot to medical school.
Right,
so the applications went up in a competitive landscape.
Gotcha, yeah.
So then next thing you know, I'm in Compton City College. This is the city from the Serena Williams sisters.
Yeah.
NWA and now Kendrick Lamar. I found a professor there, an English professor. And he said something to me. I know you, because he figured out, like, this guy, you know, you're going to be fine, you know. But he said, I know you'll do well, but I hope you do good. So I held on to that. Mm-hmm. And later on, I dedicated a textbook to him. I don't even know his first name was Mr. Jet. Uh-huh. So all of those things happened because I took the circuitous route, the tangential route, obliquity. I took some chances. I mean, I take health chances. I didn't take life chances. Mm-hmm. And so it... it redirected me, and then, you know, I had to get straight A's for a couple of years, and I had borderline, you know, marks, and got lucky on a standardized test and got into medical school. Huh. And the first thing I did when I got into medical school, I took a year off.
Right.
I said, I'm exhausted. It's time to party again and relax. The partying with a medical school admission in your pocket, that's a good feeling.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
Versus I'm partying, but I don't know where I'm going.
Yeah.
And then medical school happened, and I thought I was going to be... You know, I didn't like medical school, again, to be frank, because it was classroom work. Next thing you know, I'm in L.A. County General Hospital. 2,200 beds. A place where the gangs at that time had actually come in and shot and killed doctors.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, and I was like, this is metal detectors to go in. Mm. And it was this whole ocean of life in there. And I fell in love. Fell in love with people. And went into surgery because I thought I was going to be a heart surgeon, then I didn't actually go directly into neurosurgery. It's a different discipline over there you have to apply directly into.
Yeah.
I didn't have the marks for it, and I didn't have any exposure to it. But when I was in general surgery in San Diego, just about 150 kilometers south of Los Angeles, they had an opening in neurosurgery, and they had seen me 1 month on their service, if you will. Mm. And they said, hey, you know, so they picked me up. So it was, another random way to get into brain surgery, right?
Yeah.
4 years into brain surgery.
Because you were doing cardiothoracics, right?
Yeah.
Before then.
Yeah.
And then, you kind of pivoted because someone told you, you know, there was an opening, and it's very fortuitous at the time.
And before I pivoted, I said, can I at least see what brain surgery looks like? I had never seen it.
Yeah.
Because in medical school, if you're not going into it or coveting the position potentially, you probably won't even drift through there. Mm. Just something to see an open skull. And it's not gray. Mm-hmm. It's not like cardboard. It's opalescent, like I wrote in the book. It's oyster with these serpentine vessels. Mm. I mean, it's something. I first thought I was like, I mean, is this possible? Because it's white. It gets 20% of the blood flow and it's white.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain that.
Yeah.
It's like, huh?
I love that section actually, because you have pullouts where you're like, you know, busted, neurobusted. Grey matter is not grey.
Yeah.
You know, it's this beautiful colour, and then underneath the white matter is a pearly white, you described. Yeah. Yeah.
And what how we fell into that misperception is they kept showing the brain once people died.
Exactly.
And they held it in their gloved hands. Well, it's not alive anymore, right? Somebody should have said, let's take some beautiful pictures in the operating room to show you. And it pulsates. Mm-hmm. Not like the heart, but it throbs. And it's floating in white, not white, excuse me, clear, odorless fluid. But they still have proteins and diseases in it. Clear fluid, shiny, pearly, opalescent material, undulating ridges. It's a sacred space. So into neurosurgery, into brain surgery I went. And then my wife got pregnant by me. since we're clarifying all.
Yeah.
I mean, she's, that's her choice. Just because we're married doesn't mean, she loses any of her freedom. I want her to choose me daily. But she's an OBGYN, so
right.
I looked at her like, I thought you were... It's not like... The birth control was all in your house.
Yes.
So I was like, huh? So another... And so she
but
was...
You're in impulse control, so... There's a bit of a... there's a collaboration there.
Yeah, we did collaborate for that pregnancy. Yes, we did. That's funny. But she was 26, I was 27, as you know, in training for this stuff. This is not a good time to have a baby, but we're going to go for it. So family helped, nannies, different cultures, different foods. We just went for a travel. Let's not hold back. Let's not pretend like this is a burden.
Yeah.
Let's party like rock stars. We have little kids now.
Yeah.
And I had this opportunity. We're supposed to, in that 7-year neurosurgery training, you're supposed to take a year of research. Again, I don't know what research means.
Yeah.
So most people could just research, like if you do this brain surgery, how many infections do you get out of 100? But San Diego is the highest per capita of neuroscientists. Remember I mentioned Salk is over there?
Yeah.
There's like 5 institutes in this bluff in San Diego overlooking the ocean. And when I went there, I was working at Children's Hospital, and for epilepsy, they would cut out parts of the brain, the temporal lobe, and we set up the arrangement, and the parents agreed, and there were no patient identifiers, so I was able to bring human brain tissue to the laboratory where they had been working on like mice brains, mouse brains, and so that was an advantage for me.
Yeah,
and I was also older, and so during those, I took another additional year, and I got enough data to get a PhD out of it. So I started as an MD in residency, and I launched at age 36 with an MD and a PhD.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, how did that happen? But and then something, again, accidental happened. Something I wasn't planning. I thought I was going to be a private practitioner. Mm. When I interviewed at City of Hope, they said, well, okay, you've got some interesting data right here. It's hot data. It's fresh.
Yeah.
It's not usually when you get an MD and a PhD, you do it in medical school, and then you do your residency or your training, and it's old data.
Yeah.
So I had hot scientific data. I had new surgical skills. I went to UCSF again. Mm-hmm. For extra cancer training. And it was weird to come back to the San Francisco General and see that now as somebody who's a participant, not just a spectator. Mm. And I've been at City of Hope for 10 years. I've got a laboratory there. It looks like CSI, that show with the Petri dishes and the fog machine. And we're trying to invent medicine. And I do only cancer surgery. And I operate on Wednesdays. I see patients on Thursdays. And Sundays are... Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Mondays are to myself. That's when I think about science. I'm always thinking about science. I'm always thinking about everything all the time. It's not I shall now work on science, as you know. And I've been fortunate enough to take some of those scientific ideas and apply to the U.S. United States government, the NIH. And last year, actually 6 months ago, we got a grant for $1.5 million to study cancer. Mm-hmm. And just to make the circle all the way back to when I had dropped out, there's 2 types of brain cancer. There's the ones you hear about Senator McCain in the United States or Ted Kennedy. It's glioma. It grows from the substance of the brain. It's the brain tissue going bad, if you will, breaking bad. But there more commonly are lung cancers and breast cancers
wanting satellite spots and spreading up there. So I study breast cancer spreading to the brain. And my mom had breast cancer. Yeah. She's doing fine. And back then, I've got her name tattooed on my arm. Mm-hmm. And it's all of that stuff. And this book, being able to share those stories all the way from San Francisco General to about a year ago, is in this book as well.
Yeah.
And it's been deeply satisfying for me to see the traction it's getting here, and how Penguin and their team have, saw something in my writing. I never met them in person.
Yeah.
They saw something in the writing, and they set up all of this, and they've sort of revealed my soul in a light better than I even could myself, because I don't know London, don't know UK. Yeah, yeah. They know you guys, and they say, hey, oh, that's interesting, and UK will like this, and we're going to put it forward in a wonderful way.
Yeah.
More than it has happened in the States. So I am just so grateful.
Well, I'm grateful that they picked up on it as well, because like I said in the first part of this pod, you do have this natural ability to segue. I mean, you've just been doing it now. You know, we've been talking about your personal experiences and how that, you know, relates to the kind of research that you're doing right now. And that those years where you were partying or, like, you know, just being yourself, it reminds me of a quote in your book where you had the pleasure of meeting Francis Crick at one point, right? And there's something that he said to you is scientists need to be more creative.
Yeah, he said, well, we all know this in the lab. Geeks make technicians. Scientists are creative.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, how dare us try to guess how Mother Nature works?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not going to be 2 + 2 = 4 and let me do data mining to understand Mother Nature, right? Yeah. So, but the creativity part, is a luxury for me to not only have a career where I can provide for my family, not only have a career that shapes my identity to where I feel good about myself, because I, you know, for the most part, I try to help people, you know, it's never not in my equation when I make decisions, going back to Mr. Jet at Compton City College, you'll do well. I hope you do good. And the luxury of this, I travel the world and Ukraine and
you do some work in Lima as well, right?
Yeah, it's been a bunch of places. And that started because I wanted to honor what he said. And that started because I wrote about that shit in my personal statement applying to medical school.
Yeah.
And even though nobody will ever know about that, I didn't want to be a liar to myself.
Gotcha.
Because I was like, I know my grades suck.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though my standardized scores are sky high, and that might seduce you, but if I get in, if I have the luxury of getting, the privilege of getting into medical school, I will give back.
Yeah.
And so I work back in LA County. There's an East LA hospital, and I speak Spanish, so I have a lot of Latino patients there. And so all of those things, there was no wasted time. You know, people feel like, especially in academics, you wasted a year. No. This is my fabric.
Yeah, yeah.
And in many ways, these tangential paths have really allowed me to surge forward in a life that, for me, was unexpected. I was dropped out of university.
Yeah,
I didn't expect to have this nuanced of a life. The luxury of creativity in my life. How am I gonna sculpt this heavenly marble? How am I going to three-dimensionally remove this cancer without disrupting the marble as much as possible? Or how does science work? And the things I daydream about, and then what am I doing in your kitchen talking about this, and my son is outside watching Kevin Hart on it. I will never forget this. This has been a very momentous week in my life, you know. And I've got some good mileage for 46.
Some
fun stuff. So it's not coming from somebody who doesn't get out and get around.
Even the way you talk, in terms of like your mind wandering, and you know, the fact that you speak a second language, and all these are all like concepts that come out in your book. And it's kind of just, your book is just like a structured way for you to express yourself. And there are benefits to this, right? There are benefits to daydreaming. There are benefits to using your left hand. I must admit something. I've actually started using my left hand to text on my phone. I actually use my phone now. It's something I started a few years ago, but then I rapidly just forgot about it. And then once I read your book again, I was like, okay, now I'm going to do that again, because that is actually harnessing those new neural connections, right?
Right, absolutely. And just in a more fundamental way, you don't want to have arthritis just in your right hand, right? you've got a lot of phone mileage to go. I don't plan on putting my phone away. So it's
And arthritis will start in your thumbs as well. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I was talking to somebody, and not knowing these things or sharing these things in an overly simplistic way has maybe made us not see our real potential. Children, you're this type of personality, you're left brain. It closes us. You know, it puts us in a rut, and the key to get out of that rut is inside us, but nobody has explained to us that that is possible. So in the book we have extreme examples to show you what I call your top speed. It's up to you if you want to get out of first gear. I'm not here to be preachy and say, do this. And I'm not that guy.
You don't sound puritanical at all.
Yeah, right? I was talking to somebody the other day. I want to be allowed to do things that are dangerous or hurtful to myself. I just don't want to be misinformed about them. If I want to have a cigarette, I just wanted to know and have known from decades past that it was dangerous. If you want to play American football, we didn't do our generation a favor by lying to them that it was just like boxing. But we knew, if you go into boxing, everybody knew for the 100 years, well, you get punched drunk and there's dementia pugilis. There are all these words that say you bang your head against the wall or fist too much, it's going to mess up that delicate jellyfish inside. We knew that. And then if you choose it, that's fine. I love free will and freedom. I just don't like misinformation. So I just want to let people know, for example, on creativity, some patients with dementia, when their frontal lobe withers, the CEO, the boss, the things behind our forehead, there's two of them. It's a paired brain. It's a left and a right with this bridge. When that wears out, they can have dramatic improvements in their ability to paint. What are you talking about, right? Now, I'm not saying get dementia to be, I'm not saying, but that should make people say that, there's something that was tamped down. Then you have these case reports of people being hit with lightning and they can do math. And then you have, you know, savants who, you know, might have an intellectual disability. And that's in America, that's how we refer in the most respectful way. So if it isn't here, I just want to qualify that for listeners. That's my most respectful and articulate and nuanced way to talk about that, because I do take care of those patients. They can have certain mathematical abilities released. So they're, if the homeostasis in our brains is tilted, and it might be not good for you, but there are hidden talents and latent abilities inside us. That is the premise now. Then we talk about, well, I'd like to tap into those on my daily life. I'd like to tap into those if I work for Google or if I'm here in London. And then the book goes into what are the things that people can do. So I love the topic of creativity. I know four people that are wildly creative. Four types of people. Actually, five. Kids. Kids are stuff. And guess what? Their frontal lobe is not fully developed.
So that's quite interesting, isn't it? The fact that your frontal lobe isn't fully developed, and this is where you harness those sorts of the imagination, right? The sort of creativity element. Yeah, you give them a box, and they all have a whale of a time. Like I'm watching my two godsons who are in America at the moment, and just the things they come up with and how happy they are and content they are. That's
so let me answer that conundrum. The frontal lobe is not developed, and the frontal lobe is also the seat of creativity, but it's the part of the frontal lobe. I don't mean anatomically the capacity of the frontal lobe. I don't mean like corner X to squash down creativity to be able to go to school, check your emails, get on the tube, and check the checklist part of the CEO component of our frontal lobes hasn't hit maturation. We can also lose that part by getting drunk. I'm not saying get drunk, but that's what alcohol does. It disinhibits. So the inhibition capacity, not location, of the frontal lobe isn't there. So creativity is having its way as a kid. Some writers like to drink, and they feel they write better. Then we're also microdosing, people feel like they're more creative. Again, that disrupts the frontal lobe from saying, I got to check my emails, I got to get home, oh my God, I got bills, I got to all. And it should do that, because
you don't want to be walking around the park only being creative. You have, you know, you have to achieve the goals of the day to live, to eat. And then the fourth person that has is wildly creative are people with dementia. Again, frontal lobe is now physically injured. And then what I would posit is, so we know that creativity is, there's greater creativity than we deliver because the homeostasis is tamping it down, okay? Because we've got these examples. But we're all wildly creative in our dreams. And
I love that term you use, by the way, in the book, where we are all darlies of creativity when we sleep.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Like, we are, though, right?
Yeah.
Wild stuff going
on. Yeah, it's
wild. Whether we remember or not.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then I was writing this chapter on creativity. I just like, you know, yes, mind wandering is helpful. Yes, getting out, walking around is helpful, being playful. But I just didn't feel like that was nuanced and sophisticated enough for everybody.
Yeah.
So I do talk about microdosing. I do talk about, you know, a patient that has slow growing benign cancer and he lost, a TV producer lost his creativity. So to set the precedent. Mm. And then doing just, oh my gosh, just years of like looking up creativity on Google and neuroscience journals and creativity, creativity. I wasn't finding anything fresh. And then I found this thing called, it's the hypnagogic and hypnopompic period. It's the period where just the 15 minutes before you drift into sleep and the 15 minutes when you wake up. And people were saying that that might be like a portal that where you can access your subconscious. And I thought, this sounds over the top.
Yeah.
But there's science behind it.
Yeah.
Before the science, I actually saw this amazing thing by Salvador Dali, 50 Secrets of Magical Craftsmanship. And he's always talking about using slumber as his as the pawn from which he finds all his magic, right? I was like, this, but look at his stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then the science. So if, you know, if you're not a child and I don't encourage you to drink. I don't encourage you to go backwards in time. Well, some people might want that, but I don't encourage you to have dementia. We've established those precedents, and I don't encourage microdosing. But if you can harness sleep for creativity, here's an interesting thing. There are the brain is electric, and if you put a sticker on the head, you can detect electricity. Mm-hmm. Just like if you put a sticker on the heart, you can detect a heart rhythm. Mm-hmm. And the rhythms that 15 minutes while you're awake and drifting to sleep, you actually have dual overlapping readouts. One is awake and relaxed, that Zen flow state that maybe Tom Brady has when he throws the ball, or a ballerina has on that. You're not thinking when you're dancing, you know, that's an alpha state.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And but you also have this light sleep dreaming wave. And those two waves, there's never any two waves. It's either one or the other. There's four waves total. But those windows in before you fall asleep and right when you wake up, you actually have dual waves oscillating in your brain. And so to me, that was the science behind, you're awake, but you're drifting. And we're wildly creative when we're dreaming. And this is the concept of hypnagogic and hypnopompic periods as a way. And on the practical level of what I've done, and I have done for a long time, I like to look at the tumors before I go to bed. Once all the checklist stuff is done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can't be thinking about emails and fighting. And so then I look at it and I just kind of let it float and just, all right, man, and wake up and kind of look at it again. And I take my notes then before I go to bed. I have a notepad. I use my phone for the notes app and I always have different headings. And so that's the best I can do to talk to you about creativity. And I have been digging for years and years to come up with what is real. And it's in the book.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I love the way you actually utilize your sort of own ways in which you tap into creativity, because the way you describe the anatomy at the start of the book is actually very flow. It just makes total sense to even a layperson. I gave it to a friend of mine and they read it and were like, oh yeah, no, I completely understand it now. And it's almost like you've tapped into your own creativity. You sort of like put someone in your eyes and, you know, you're actually describing all the different cortices. And
that's from being security guard in Berkeley for 2 years. And that's from all those patients that talk to me and taught me how to communicate. Yeah. I learned to communicate for my patients. All of that is released in the book. It's something that I think, I actually got my teenage kid reading it. It was just, It was the moment. If I could have 1 billion readers or one, I would take that one. You know, can you imagine your teenage kid? And we were flying to Bolivia when it happened. Where he and I had done coca leaves to deal with altitude sickness. And I put that in there.
Yeah, you did.
Under smart drugs. And I looked over and he was and he had the book open. I was glad to see he was right side up. And then, like, you know, 15 minutes later, he was asleep and the book was on the floor. But still, just that he thought, I'm going to try to read Daddy's book. It's been good. It's been really good.
You're probably expecting us to just talk about food the whole time. But actually, I found some of the most profound bits of the book were about you talking about breathing and meditation and how you were trying to debunk the myth that this is all alternative practitioners. And actually, there's tons of evidence looking at, you know, intervention trials where you can change the volume of the hippocampus, the volume and the connections between the amygdala. That I found very, very interesting. Would you mind talking about?
I would love to. You tell me when I'm doing too much, or going too long. I dream about these things. I think about these things. Like all these. I've been privileged to see so many interesting things. Nobody's ever connected it in a deliverable package. So meditation, I'm not sure I know what meditation means, because what happened in Los Angeles, it became mindfulness, and it became, then I started seeing these things about the mindfulness of dishwashing. I was like, well, I don't need to, and then it's almost like a guilt trip. Like, if you're not happy being stuck in traffic, you're not in the present, you're not understanding mindfulness. And I don't want to be, again, I'm not trying to diminish people. I'm just telling you what I looked at. I was like, I can't. It's not like everything has to be proven, but this book, the things I have in there, even if they sound wild or they sound like an established principle is being smashed, there are personal stories, scientific references, but not in a way that it's over the top. There's proof in there. And so meditation, I don't know what that is, but I know a few things. I know Buddhist monks can think down their heart rate. I know my cancer patients after surgery, sometimes if they meditate, let's just use the word, but they need less opiates. I know deep divers before they go down for like, how long can I hold my breath? They are grabbing the mind-body connection. They're doing something. And it's not chemicals that are being released. So what is that? It's the vagus nerve. I've operated on the vagus nerve. So when a Buddhist monk thinks down his heart rate or her heart rate, I don't know, are there female Buddhist monks?
That's a very good point.
But when somebody meditates down there...
I should look that up, actually.
when they think down their heart rate, it's going through a nerve that's sprouted from the deep parts of their brain, and it comes down to the side of our throat. It's the vagus nerve. We're taught about it. It's by the carotid. You know, it's the three things in that area. It's like, and when you feel for your pulse in your neck, it's in there. And it goes around your heart and lungs and even into your guts. That's why when you get nervous, you feel it in your gut. You didn't really feel it in your gut. Your brain felt it. And the way the ripples came out, it just went down the vagus nerve, which is wrapped around your gut. That's why you get butterflies in your tummy. So I started to understand that, okay, the brain is sending signals down. Now that's established, right? We can all agree. Can the signals go in reverse? Can the body affect the brain? Can the body calm the brain? There's a thing called vagal nerve stimulator. People can just look it up if they're listening. So you can see, like, wait, these are things that have been around for 20 years. Yeah. It's a little coil. It looks like a spring in a pen that makes the pen bouncy, and it's to a wire. And we make a little cut, and we wrap it around the vagus nerve, and we leave a little generator under the collarbone, much like the patients have for heart reasons, and it tickles the vagus nerve with electricity, and it's a treatment for epilepsy. So again, tickling the vagus nerve with our little surgical device can calm the electricity of your brain. Okay, so now we've got an example that's been around for a while, that the nerve can work in reverse. It's bidirectional, two-way highway. And then what happens is breathing. A long 1, 2, 3 breath. We'll hold for 1, 2, 3, and then out 3, 2, 1. Just a little bit of that. that's been going on for millennia. Has it been duping people for 3,000 years? But that's not enough of a reason for a skeptic. Some of those patients that have epilepsy and don't have the little coil, we do this bizarre thing. When we can't tell where the epilepsy starts, we can't treat it sometimes. This is when pills fail. Yeah. This is like at the highest level of specialty centers. Pills fail, everything fails, diet fails, everything fails, right? Because diet can tamp down electricity. We actually open up their skull, scalp, skull. We lay a little grid, a thin grid, like 20 stamps connected to each other, little wires coming up. Just plop it right on the surface. So it's brain surgery, but it's not inside the brain surgery. And the wires come out, and they live in the hospital for a week. So you've got all these patients that we're doing it for a clinical purpose, and then in come these grad students, they're 25, they're 35, and they're wild, and they have these ideas, like, can we please talk to your patient? Because our patients are bored hanging out with a 24-hour readout of their brain electricity, like, from the brain, not a sticker on the skull.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so all these San Diego students, they're just like, this is the best.
Yeah.
And they came in, and they started doing these deep breathing techniques with them, and they recorded the electricity calming down. The electricity going more into that alpha state, the calm but awake state. And that's in a publication. That's not my story. That's me putting the whole story together. So before you see your boss, or when I pull in on Wednesdays for my operation, pull in at 7, I just take 5 minutes and do that, and I go in there. I'm not saying you shouldn't take Xanax, or you should. I'm not going there. I'm just saying you have these abilities that we have not shared with you. It is my fault, it is our fault that we have not shown you with all the powers you are self-equipped.
Absolutely.
And so before you, during the day, if you do this a couple of times, and if it works for you, to me, that's meditation. And really, it's what I call meditative breathing. So that's my whole thing about breath and life.
I really appreciate that, actually, because I think a lot of patients are told that there isn't much in their locus of control. And I think that sort of permission to actually, actually you can do some things that are going to impact your physiology, that are going to make you healthful, is really powerful for a lot of patients. Because when you are a patient, and this kind of stems from my experience actually becoming a patient when I was a junior doctor, it's a very embarrassing and vulnerable state. And when you can't figure out, in my case, it was, I've talked about this in previous episodes where I had atrial fibrillation and going up at 200 beats per minute. There's no reason why I should have had that medical issue. There is no family history. There are no triggers, nothing like that. And yet it was happening to me. So that dysfunction of your body and not being able to understand, particularly as a medic as well, why this is happening, it's very disarming. And when you can actually teach people, okay, you know, we do have medications, we do have interventions, we have surgeries, we have all these different things. Why don't we complement that with a whole arsenal of other safe lifestyle practices that we know can have significant effects on our physiology?
It has to be that way. And even if we don't get the pills gone, at least maybe you'll need less. Even if you need to keep the pills, you'll drive your health, not just, I take Fortin substance and it does something magical. You'll be the driver of your care. And when, like my father used to say, you go in there like, take this pill, take that pill. And he's like, no, he wouldn't take them. If you can't explain to me what is wrong, what right looks like, and how we're going to get there, I'm not going to listen to your suggestions. That's where all these listicles and these quick things on TV and different things, just every day it's do this, do this, do this. People are fed up with that. There needs to be explanation. There needs to be empowerment. And then what my feeling is, then people will say, I love pills in the right. If I have cancer, I love that people are trying to make better chemotherapy. I may choose it, I may not. If I have an infection, I love that there's penicillin. And thank that guy for finding it on that piece of bread or whatever he did. So in some ways, we've become adversarial.
Yeah.
I'm proud that there are pills that can help.
Yeah.
But people hate pills. But if they become the drivers, they'll see that pills are this option for them. Pills are their partner. If their own changes and their own modifications to their diet, their well-being, their thoughts, their lifestyle, if that's not enough, we can supplement a little bit. If you change your diet and your cholesterol doesn't go down as much as we need it to, then we'll bring in pill at a lower dose. That way, they respect people respect what docs do, medics do, and medics respect that people need to be treated as individuals and drive their own care, man.
I totally agree. And, you know, that blending of the science behind both of those disciplines, both lifestyle, diet, all the different sort of meditative techniques as well, integrated with pharmaceuticals, with surgical interventions. That's the way. I mean, someone seeing patients who sometimes can be quite egregious against pharmaceuticals, and mm-hmm. I'm a conventionally trained doctor. Yes, I believe in lifestyle and the power of food and everything else, but at the same time, I dish out antibiotics every time I'm working in an A&E. I dish out a whole bunch of different pills whenever I'm in general practice, but I complement that with all the rest of it as well. And I think you hit the nail on the head. An informed patient appreciates what you're doing for them and will therefore appreciate the science and the nuance behind all the different treatment modalities that we have.
We have this ridiculous word called compliance.
Yeah.
Like, compliance is when you send me that ridiculous training module I have to do more and more all the time. I mean, that's corporate compliance, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
click, click, click. And so, you know, I try to get my wife and kids to do some of them. I hope that doesn't make its way back. But the compliance thing is patient compliance with medication. How do we turn them into, like, 66%? No. If they're not taking the pills, it's because we did not impart upon them why and how. Your blessed rations have, take this. When nobody explained to them, listen, these arteries you have, if you keep pumping this hard to get the blood to run through these arteries, because they're all choked down, your heart is going to wear out. Pumping against high blood pressure. What is high blood pressure? Oh, my blood pressure is high. What does that mean? It means, it's like blowing through a narrower straw. You're going to exhaust your heart. Do you want to exhaust your heart? And then it can actually get, the heart gets bigger. And in this case, a big heart is not good. You get hypertrophic cardio stuff, things you would know better. So they have to understand. And then that also liberates them if they don't take their blood pressure medicine for the weekend. It's not like, oh, then you have patients on the other side who are become imprisoned by the pills. But if you understand this is a glacial thing, you don't want to run your blood pressure this high over the next few years. You're going to wear out your heart. So let's start the process of making it easy. Let's befriend your heart a little bit. Why don't you give up the salt a little bit? Why don't you do these things a little bit? We'll check in a little while. If your modifications can bring down your blood pressure, we're in a good spot. We're not going to take pills.
Absolutely.
And then if it isn't, then we'll try a little baby pill. But there's no education and information in that way. And because we don't communicate well, we have to be so smart to get into medical school that I actually made this suggestion in medical school that I think they were trying to kick me out. I said, everybody should have to work at Taco Bell or Starbucks or Subway for at least 1 month to know how to talk to people. Because, you're just studying all the time. It's that competitive.
Yeah.
That there's no learning of communication, of taking complex things, not dumbing them down, but taking the essence. And each patient is different. The CEO might need a different explanation. The person who I only speak Spanish to, I might use different words. But achieving that effect in the patient, that's real compliance. So whenever I see a patient isn't compliant with something, I think it's my fault.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good point. Because, like, you know, the number of patients that I've seen with type 2 diabetes, it's just become another condition that you can take a pill for now. And the gravity of the condition, not to scare patients, but just to make them understand that there are ways around it without medications, and it's a stepwise process. If we rely on pharmaceuticals alone and we don't do anything else, it is just a time before that becomes 2, becomes 3, becomes insulin, becomes all the other micro and macrovascular complications, one of which is dementia, which you talk about in the book as well.
You mess with the blood vessels in your body, those are the same ones going to your brain. And that flesh needs to be irrigated as much as the rest of your body does. And in fact, it's quite brittle. You don't irrigate it right for 3 or 4 minutes, it'll die on you. But the kidney I can take out and put in another person and put in an ice cooler. It's extremely important to have cardiovascular health for your brain. But back to diabetes, somebody explained it to me. Well, I can't remember who it was. He said, well, the patient educated me. I was trying to explain to him. And he says, oh, it's like putting diesel in my car when it is unleaded. I said, exactly. None of us put the, we go to the gas, there's 100% compliance of putting the right fuel in our cars, but we can't explain to people like, hey, having that much sugar flowing around your blood vessels is tearing them up on the inside. Yeah. And when you tear them up, they clog, they wither, and we got to cut off your leg sometime, and you block off the flow to your heart and your brain. You don't want that. You're putting the, diabetes is corrosive. Because people say, oh, high blood sugar, but that by itself doesn't explain it. High blood sugar is corrosive to your plumbing. And he said, I had that conversation with him. I was like, I like that. I'm going to use that. Yeah. I remember telling him, if I ever use it, I'm going to tell. I can't remember the patient name. I'm going to footnote that I learned that from my patient.
Yeah. There's so much that I learned from my patients in terms of the vernacular that I should be using, the way I should be describing things to patients. And particularly when it comes to food, you know, instead of me being prescriptive about, okay, you eat this for your brain and you eat this for your skin, you eat this for your immune system, you eat it for your body, and your body has this ability to look after itself. So, you know, looking at sugar, for example, sugar isn't just about diabetes, type 2 diabetes that we're talking about. It's about brain health. It's about your immune health as well, and different types of fibers and how that impacts your gut microbiota. You know, getting into this way of describing things as individual silos is actually quite damaging to the real understanding of how our bodies work.
Yeah, I totally agree. And now, what I'll say, so if people think, well, you're against a monumental challenge, I would say we were in the 1900s with infection. Mm. We were with polio. We were with AIDS. Now, AIDS... for people who can get the medicine, they can live 20, 30 years. So we've made these dents. I'm working on cancer. I think your mission, clearly from what you've written, which is great for me because I don't get the liberty to talk like this with my surgical colleagues. We don't really talk like this, but I believe this, and because I have kids. And
yeah, absolutely.
So you're also liberating me to talk about things in this way, than not in a technical way. But so the change that we are trying to create now, we may not see for a decade. But we definitely won't see in a decade if we don't try now. And that's why I always give that talk about, well, a patient said that to me. You know, the patients, when they're dying of cancer, they want to not only take medicines that are on the brink of being released to the general population because they have shown promise, and current medications aren't enough in each of those scenarios, let's say, for those individual patients. They want to participate in the development of medicine and science. They are well aware it's not for them only. And they're well aware that half of them are getting a placebo, that they're probably not even getting the active ingredient. And they're passionately dedicated to clinical trials for the generation ahead. Yeah. So what you're doing, and what I'm seeing here in London, a new light, is that the message, the podcast, the content, everything is, so 10, 15 years from now, you see some kids running around, and they believe these things, these foods are good for them, and they take it for granted, this knowledge, because it's just... it's inculcated inside them because of the shifts and changes you're trying to make now. Yeah. So I think it is very powerful. And you know, when I was younger, I was sort of put super specialist above everything. Yeah. And now that I'm less, you know, getting in my 40s, 46 years old, I'm seeing that maybe I do a lot with each patient, but these global health, these well-being messages will change countries, will change generations and nations. And it's very important that somebody is doing that. So I just really enjoy talking to you about these kind of things.
And that was my conversation with Dr. Rahul. You can find him at drjanyo.com. And if I could give you three challenges on the back of this podcast to do, it's for 1 week, try using your non-dominant hand when using your iPhone or brushing your teeth. It really is tricky at the start of it. The more you do it, the more dexterity you actually get in that left hand. And maybe it has some benefits cognitively as well. Try meditation this week. Try and do at least 10 minutes twice a day. Book it in for 7 days, whatever you're doing. It may have some benefits to the cortices of your brain. It may have some benefits to your working memory as well, and emotional intelligence. It really is something that I found personally incredible to use on a daily basis, and I try and do it as much as possible, particularly before doing a shift in A&E. And the third thing is, look at your diet and look out for the mind diet. It's something I talked about in my last book, Eat to Beat Illness. The mind diet is essentially a modified Mediterranean diet where the focus is on vegetables, colours, but particularly greens. You can find lots of different types of greens in the UK and abroad. Swiss chard, broccoli, rocket, dandelion greens, and berries as well. Black currants, blueberries, raspberries, all absolutely fantastic and packed full of brain benefiting compounds. His book, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon, is out now in all good bookstores. I highly recommend you pick up a copy. His storytelling, if that alone, is worth the purchase, and I really, really did enjoy reading the book. Subscribe to the website where I give you weekly recipes, content, and much more to help you live the healthiest and happiest life. Give us a 5-star rating if you like this podcast. It really does help spread the love and the message. Tweet us at The Doctor's Kitchen. Instagram is doctors_kitchen, as are all the other handles, and YouTube as well for the recipe attached to this podcast. I'll catch you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.